Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. This week we have a special pre-Paris Olympic episode where we speak with Michael Waters, who is the author of the truly groundbreaking book, The Other Olympians: Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sport. This is a story of the early trans Olympic athletes dating back almost a century and their legacy, which we are still feeling in the ways that the International Olympic Committee navigates sex and gender. This book is an incredible accomplishment. It fills a gap in our history of the Olympics, resistance, sexuality, and gender. People from all walks of life have approached me and said, "Have you read this book?" People who are sports fans, people who are queer activists. Like, I'm getting it all over the place from people who are asking me, "Have you read this book, The Other Olympians?" And with this podcast, hopefully, we'll put that to rest. So we're so happy to have him on the show, Michael Waters. Sir, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. What an intro. I'm really happy to hear that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's borderline grating. Like, people who have nothing to do with sports are saying, "Have you seen The Other Olympians?" People who before have only cared about sports, "Have you gotten The Other Olympians? That really seems like something you'd like." And I'm like, yes, I know about the book. But the one great thing I'll say about it is that it meets that level of buzz and excitement that people are approaching me with. So it is not undeserved, but hopefully this podcast will put those questions to rest.
Yeah, you have other things to focus on, so.
Yes. Well, I want you to start, though, please, because the story, it's a very involved narrative. And I'm hoping, so it's not me talking here, you could tell our listeners the story, the narrative that you put forward in The Other Olympians.
Yeah, absolutely. And so The Other Olympians, you know, it's like a queer history book. And it does touch on a lot of different things, you know. It talks about like the Berlin Olympics. It talks about the rise of fascism, queer history generally. But really, it's a narrative centered on this one athlete in particular, this kind of little known Czech sprinter named Zdeněk Kobek, who was assigned female at birth and played in women's sports in the early 1930s and actually won a gold medal in the 800 meter dash. Before sort of stepping away from sports and then transitioning gender and announcing in December 1935 that going forward he would live as a man and play in men's sports.
Sorry to interrupt, Michael. Was it 1932 when that medal was won?
He won his gold medal in 1934 at the Women's World Games, which was like this rival to the Olympics existed in the 20s and 30s, basically because there was no, like at this time when Kobek was playing in the 1930s, the Olympics didn't have very many women's track and field sports at all, for all sorts of like sort of misogynistic reasons and all these like kind of like anxieties around gender. And so yeah, he played at the Women's World Games, which was like the highest level of competition available to him. And then he wins this gold medal. He actually sets a new world record for the 800 meters in the process. And then he steps away from sports, and sort of transitions gender and announces that he's living as a man. And you know, I kind of stumbled on this story by accident, but I think what fascinated me so much from the start is that Kobach was, I think, like treated with this sense of like real curiosity when he transitions gender. You know, this is the 1930s that we're talking about, and I think like it's easy to have this idea of the 1930s as being, you know, potentially regressive on an issue like this. And you know, like while the coverage of Kobach, you know, they would honestly get his pronouns confused quite a bit. They would use words that like we wouldn't use today to describe him. But like through it all, there is this real sense of curiosity about him and about this, honestly, just like this possibility of transition itself. And you know, like I started doing this research in 2021 from the vantage point of, you know, like publications like the New York Times writing these like transphobic op-eds, you know, seemingly every week or every month. And it was striking to see that like the 1930s, there was this moment of a different conversation. And then, you know, I think the other layer to the book, which does get a little more muddled and sort of confusing to untangle, but is that in this kind of oblique way in response to Kobach's transition, you know, while the public is very like interested in him and embracing of him, you see this like very small group of sports officials who see this idea of gender transition as a threat to their like categorization of sports. And ultimately what happens is the Track and Field Federation, which was called the IAAF at the time, in August 1936 at the Berlin Olympics, passes this really early version of sex testing policies, basically saying,
I want to
yeah.
underline this because it's so important. Sex testing, first, if you could give a good definition of what that is, starts at the Berlin Hitler 36 Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, I mean, what sex testing even is has changed so much. I think broadly you can define it as like this attempt to sort of measure the bodies of athletes in women's sports and decide like who is allowed to participate and who is not. And you know, it's gone through a lot of iterations over the decades. This first version of it was literally just a strip test. But you know, like there later, the Olympics would have chromosome tests, later hormone tests. N now, like sex testing doesn't exist in the same way, but there are all these like eligibility requirements that specifically limit trans women and intersex women from playing, and even cis women who have like high hormone levels from playing in a lot of women's sports. So, kind of modern day sex testing, it doesn't fully exist, but it exists in the form of eligibility requirements. But all of that traces back to 1936, to the Berlin Olympics, like you said.
Wow. It's so interesting to me as I was looking at this because Kobach is transitioning becomes a trans man. And do you think the discussion would have been different if it was reversed? Because you see so much of the hysteria now is around trans and intersex women. Did that play into it at all, do you think? Did that affect the coverage? Did that matter even to people back then?
I think definitely. I mean, I think it's hard to do the counterfactual, but I think the fact that Kobach transitioned gender and was trying to play in men's sports, like for sure impacted kind of how he was received. And even at the time that he was transitioning, he was kind of stepped away from sports for a while. And so he was kind of received of as this like former athlete who was now transitioning. And so the dialogue around him was different than it is now, specifically around a lot of trans women. And I think it is kind of interesting that Kobach, in this oblique way, like that sports officials reacted to him in a way that created sex testing policy focused on women's sports, when, you know, he is like wanting to live as a man and play as a man. And I think like to unpack why that is, you first of all have to understand that like this was the 1930s. This was an era when There was no concept of gender as this sort of like psychological idea distinct from like biological sex. And so, even when Kobach himself was talking about his transition, he would describe it as like his body metamorphosizing. It would be like the idea of transition would be framed in these very like physical terms. And sports officials who passed these first policies didn't really have a desire to even understand, I think, the nuances of the body and of sex and of what would eventually become gender. And they saw the fact that Kobach had played in women's sports at all as some kind of issue. And it's possible that Kobach like would have fit under some sort of intersex umbrella. We don't really know that to be true. I think some sports officials in the 1930s assumed as much, which is maybe explains why they eventually created these regulations around women's sports. But there was just like a lot of misinformation. And I think really what it boils down to is that they saw trend like the idea of transitioning gender and moving between these categories as something that needed to be regulated and controlled. And that was really stark because it was so different from the public reaction to him. And so yeah, to answer your question, I think the public would have felt differently if he were sort of a trans woman. That wouldn't have been like the identity label that didn't exist at the time, but if he was transitioning and trying to live as a woman and play in sports, yeah, maybe it would have been different on the public end. But I think it is striking that like the way the news covered him was trying to explain like, oh, how was it actually possible to move between male and female categories? What are the medical availabilities at the time? And also, you would see these op-eds from doctors in the 1930s talking about how, people like Kobach are actually quite common and that, like sort of male and female categories are a little more porous than I think most people thought. And so that was like a real discussion point that you would read in even major sports magazines. Like the biggest sports magazine was called Physical Culture at the time. And they had this big piece about Kobach, and about like why athletes were transitioning at all. And it really got at this idea of like, there are a lot of people out there who are moving between these categories. So, the public definitely was having a different conversation than sports officials were.
How do you explain that? Like, how do you explain the openness of the 1930s relative to a lot of the closed-mindedness today? Like, as you said, we would imagine the 30s to even be more aggressive than today, but there was an opening for a different kind of conversation. What was it about the 1930s, or perhaps what was it about Kobach that inspired a different kind of conversation?
Yeah, well, I think when Kobach transitioned, it was kind of at the tail end of this like really significant moment for queer people, really across like major cities across the world. And so, like if you think about like the late 1920s in New York and Berlin, like if you think about like the movie Cabaret, this was a moment of like really surprising queer visibility in sort of like nightlife and theater. In New York, people would be going to drag shows in Harlem as like this kind of like tourist attraction. And this was also an era where Magnus Hirschfeld, who is this famous sexologist, had this like really like successful institute in Germany, which would be giving medical care to intersex and trans people. And so I mentioned that because I think the 1930s are at kind of the tail end of this moment of like queer, some kind of queer visibility, this like burgeoning sort of healthcare that's available to, I mean, this is ultimately a small group of people, but to some people who wanted to transition. And yeah, I mean, I think that there was this sense of, science is changing. We're like people, just even day-to-day people are learning so many new things about like the body and about how sex worked, and about like biological sex itself. That I think it just felt like there was a lot of new science and there was a lot of new sort of possibilities to understand with these technologies and with sort of like rising visibility. And so I think like people were kind of just primed to accept that, like, oh, okay. And so, like, on top of everything else that we're learning about ourselves, like, these categories of male and female are a little more permeable than we thought. And I mean, obviously, it's like, it's also, you know, like, I don't want to also over glamorize the 1930s. There was a lot of like really real roadblocks to Quebec getting healthcare itself. You know, like the doctors who were offering this medical care often had very like regressive views and would only do certain kinds of operations and only if patients said certain things. You know, it's, I mean, this was not like an era to overly glamorize, but I think what is striking is that you see the beginnings of this attempt to grapple with, you know, just like this larger spectrum of like people and of gender, and we kind of threw that out the window at a certain point. And yeah, I guess what is different today, perhaps, is just that there has been a more of an effort to create a backlash. You know, Quebec was one of the first high-profile people to transition, at least on a global stage. And perhaps there just like wasn't enough time to even create a backlash around him. I'm not sure. It's hard to know exactly, but I do think a big part of it is that he kind of was like at the end of this moment of queer, like some kind of queer golden age.
So if Quebec is at the tail end of this golden age that really emerges in the 1920s, it's also on that edge before the rise of fascism. Could you tell us a little bit about the 1936 Berlin Olympics and combining that fascist spectacle with the need to catalog gender and how that became such an obsession of Olympic officials?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, the 1936 Olympics, like you've alluded to, you know, this is like the Hitler-hosted, Nazi-hosted Olympics. And you know, in the lead up to the 1936 Olympics, there is in the US especially, but really across Europe, there is this like really strong boycott movement of different kind of like anti-fascist, Jewish activists, other activists, saying that like we shouldn't be sending our teams to Berlin, we shouldn't be normalizing this ideology and giving kind of Hitler this like big global platform to promote himself. And what ends up happening is that like in the US context, there is this one sports official named Avery Brundage, who was at the time the head of the American Olympic Committee and would later become a member of the IOC and then IOC president. He was very influential in the IOC's history, but he was the main voice in the US saying, no, we should have the Berlin Olympics. And in fact, he was like quite sympathetic to the Nazis themselves and to their ideologies. Like I looked at his letters when doing this book, and you know, he certainly agreed with a number of their talking points. And so the context is that a lot of the sports officials who are involved in the Berlin Olympics, whether they are Germans themselves or even people like Brundage who are, you know, representing other countries, I mean, they certainly have this some level of sympathy, I guess, for the Nazi regime in a lot of cases. And again, you can see this in their letters. And I think that is kind of important for understanding who eventually are the people who pass this first version of sex testing policies. You know, these are people who are certainly already inclined towards a certain belief system. And basically, like the boycott movement runs parallel to some of these discussions around Quebec and around gender. For a bit of context, you know, even before this, like there was always a ton of anxiety from especially sports officials around women's sports. And I should also say, like, this is an era when basically all of the prominent sports officials associated with the IOC and the international federations are men, and not just men, but like almost entirely white men, almost entirely white men who come from aristocratic backgrounds. You know, these were unpaid positions to be a sports official at the time, and you had to be able to afford to travel the world and like take, you know, months at a time off of work because, you know, you have to ride a steamship, for instance, to get around. And so these male sports officials had a lot of fears about women's sports and about like sports and especially sports like track and field being masculinizing to women in some way or endangering their health. There are all sorts of like rumors that would be going around. And I think Kobach's transition, this idea of an athlete like playing in women's sports and then deciding to live as a man, sort of, I think to some sports officials, like reaffirmed their own anxieties around masculine women. And so what you have at the Berlin Olympics is this really heightened scrutiny around women athletes in general. And there are a couple athletes in particular who were like really a source of fixation. There's this one American sprinter named Helen Stevens who had, you know, she's a cis woman, but she had a deep voice from a childhood accident and also just had like something as simple as like large biceps. And that really made her a target of a lot of scrutiny by sports officials. And there was this kind of drama that happened where this one newspaper accused her of being a man. It's not really clear even what they meant by that. But yeah, like the Berlin Olympics has not just this. Is not just a platform for the Nazis, but is also where you see a lot of these anxieties around women's sports culminating. And so it's perhaps not surprising that there is this policy that is passed at the Berlin Olympics. And I should say that like the IOC at the behest of Avery Brundage considers a sex testing policy for women's sports at the time, and they ultimately decide to leave it to the federations. And so the IAAF is the only federation that ends up passing a sex testing policy at the time. And so, you know, that's like really the origins of all of this stuff and all of these eligibility requirements in women's sports is this one little policy that the Track and Field Federation passes at the Berlin Olympics. And I think it happens within track and field because so much of the anxiety and scrutiny is really focused on that set of sports.
Is this done with a wink and a nod from Brundage? Is this something that he wants to see? I mean, it is interesting him offloading it to the federations.
Yeah, well, he was also at the time a member of the IAAF. He was head of their rules committee, I believe. Maybe someone should check me on that. But he had like a position on the executive board of the IAAF. So he was both an IOC member and an IAAF member. And so in addition to Brundage, there's this one other figure who was really influential in passing that sex testing policy. And that's this sports doctor named Wilhelm Knoll, who was head of this like international group of sports physicians that would be advising like sports officials on policy. And Wilhelm Knoll was actually the first person to like raise an alarm about Kobach. So like the month after Kobach announces that he's living as a man, Wilhelm Knoll writes this op-ed talking about how worried he is about the future of women's sports. It's not, again, it's not really clear what he's worried about. And he writes letters to all of the individual federations, including the Track and Field Federation, urging them to create medical exams focused on women's competitions. And so, you know, it's also his endorsement that I think eventually gets the Track and Field Federation to pass this policy. And the other fact about Wilhelm Knoll is that he's a registered Nazi and like a true ardent believer. Like he taught at a university and would wear his brown shirt uniform to classes. And so even in the way that he was describing Kobach and sort of making the case for sex testing, you can see just that sort of those fascist and eugenics beliefs kind of creeping in. You know, he was someone who didn't want non-white people to be playing in sports. He didn't want people he deemed quote unquote unsuitable to be playing in sports, Jewish athletes playing in sports. And so he seemed to treat like gender minorities in the same way. And so I think that's important context is to understand that like these policies were quite poorly thought out, but they were also passed by people who were just primed to see kind of any kind of minority as being worth pushing out. And so yeah, it's really Brundage and Knoll that come together to pass that first policy. In the Track and Field Federation.
So who is Mark Weston and how does he play into this story?
Yeah, so Mark Weston in my book maybe gets like second fiddle, but he was a little bit less successful of an athlete, and also honestly, like there's a little bit there's a lot less sourcing on him, so I had to reduce the section on him. But he is also a somewhat prominent athlete who is assigned female at birth, plays in women's sports, plays at the Women's World Games. He doesn't medal. I think he comes in sixth. He's this British shot putter, and he retires from sports, sort of embarks on this career as a massage therapist, and then in June, or sorry, in May 1936, a few months after Kobeck transitions, Mark Weston also announces that going forward he's going to be living as a man. And you know, Weston is like really done with sports. He just has a massage career. But I think the fact that two athletes who had some amount of profile transitioned in the same period really brought this story just to a larger audience. And it meant that, you know, Time magazine shortly after ran an article sort of being like, why are so many athletes transitioning? You know, the fact that Weston came shortly after Kobeck, I think, created a sense of like, oh, maybe there's some sort of pattern here, or possibly just sorry, just that the sense that there's some sort of pattern here. And I think Weston is the person that Brundage seemed to most refer to. I think Brundage sort of forgot Kobeck's name, and so he would often talk about this British shot putter. But I think, yeah, together they create this like big media story around kind of the flimsiness of male and female categories, and in the case of sports officials, the need to do something.
So I want to get to 2024, and I'm hoping you could speak a little bit about gender testing today and how it could have been different if some of what we saw in the 1930s was allowed to flower in the ensuing decades. I mean, I assume some of that piece would be we wouldn't have gender policing, but I'm hoping maybe you could speak about how it's done today and how it could be done differently.
Yeah. So the policies that exist today. So first of all, like there was a time in during the Cold War when the IOC itself would create like overarching policies around who was allowed to play in women's sports and who was not. So eventually this policy goes from this perfunctory rule that the IAAF passed to this IOC level policy. What has happened more recently is the IOC no longer sets overarching policy on eligibility. And they released a statement in 2021 pointing towards their desire for, they say, like inclusion of trans and intersex women in women's sports. But they gave the authority to the international federations to decide what to do. And basically, what has happened is that a very large number of these international federations have passed policies, in many cases outright banning basically all trans women from women's sports, and also keeping a lot of intersex women and cis women who might have high testosterone levels just naturally from women's sports as well. And so these are now like taking the form of these eligibility requirements rather than like on-site sex testing that we had in the 20th century. But I think the effects are not too different, which is that we are sort of creating a system where only certain kinds of women get to count and get to play. And I think what is striking to me is that in the 1930s, like, you know, it's easy to do the counterfactual. So I'm just going to disclaim that. Like, this is all a bit of counterfactual. But I think in the 1930s, you see this real desire from people to grapple with sort of just this new spectrum of gender and of biological sex that they are confronting. You know, like I said, I mean, just regular people were reading these magazine stories about how, like, sex itself, like biological sex itself, was a spectrum. You know, that people are born with different sort of combinations of traits, and that there was this like known idea at the time, which is still true today, that, you know, there's no like single marker that like lets you cleave people into binaries, even when we're just talking about the physical body. You know, like what we call sex is a combination of a bunch of different sort of physical markers, not just chromosomes, but just a bunch of different things. And I think that in the 1930s, there could have been a moment to reconcile with the ways in which these male and female categories of sports are imperfect. And to talk about how just those categories themselves are imperfect and don't necessarily include everyone, or at least not in, there's like no clear way to draw like a straight line between those two binaries. And I think if we had continued some of that energy, perhaps there could have been this like bigger conversation about how to, you know, like how to include everyone in sports, the ways in which we have this sort of male and female sports system that is imperfect. How, like, do we change that? Do we just acknowledge that, you know, these categories are imperfect and we just have to accept some level of porousness within them? I think also important is that in 1936, there weren't really calls from the public to introduce sex testing policy. Like, this was really a creation of this group of sports officials who I mentioned, who were already inclined to just see kind of like anyone who was different as a threat to these sports. And even when these policies were first passed by the IAAF, you didn't see a ton of news coverage about them. I think most people honestly didn't know about them, even sports fans. But the articles that you do read were also quite critical of these policies. You know, you had this like the New York Daily News ran this column talking about how, you know, these policies were going to lead to a bad outcome and to all this fear mongering. You had like a prominent like track and field athlete from the US talking about how like this idea of cleaving people into these categories made him like quote nauseous. And so there was this moment when we just could have had a different conversation and really prioritize, I think, the humanity of these athletes and of, yeah, just prioritize the humanity of these athletes and acknowledge that, like, to get to the level where you could even compete in the Olympics is this incredible feat that requires so much talent and effort. And so the idea that we would be passing these policies that would just kind of arbitrarily decide who gets to play in women's sports and then push out anyone who, you know, at a specific moment in time, sports officials deem doesn't fit, it's just like a cruel thing to do. And it doesn't really reflect, like, I think what sports should be in theory. This is all to just say that, like, I think there was a potential for this bigger conversation. And I think what happened is just that, like, this policy of sex testing was just put on the books. Most people didn't know about it. And then, you know, World War II happened. And then after World War II, this policy was just there. And it came to feel like this inevitable part of how sports would be governed, that there would be these really tight restrictions on who gets to be a woman, basically. And during the Cold War, they just built and built, became bigger and bigger, affecting more and more sports. And we didn't have a moment to step back and say, like, what are we actually doing here? Who are we trying to keep out and why? And yeah, again, it's all a counterfactual, but I do think there was a moment when we just could have had that conversation and we just didn't. And I like to think in like today, we could also, this also could be a moment where we have that bigger conversation. When you look at the actual policies being passed by sports federations, they don't seem to want to have it. But yeah, it just feels like we didn't have to get to this point.
Now, there is a non-binary athlete at the 2020 competing at the 2024 Paris Olympics, Nikki Hiltz, but there are no trans athletes who are going to be there. There are no transgender athletes at the 2024 Paris Olympics. What does that tell us?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the reason that there are no trans athletes is because of these policies. You know, it's like these eligibility requirements have, I think, quite quietly and perniciously kept out plenty of athletes who would have wanted to try out, possibly could have made it to the Olympics from even getting the chance to try out in the first place. And I think, you know, historically, it's been really hard to know how many people are affected by these policies because sports organizations try to keep it quiet because they say they want to protect athletes' privacy, which I think makes a lot of sense. But I think the downside impact of that is that we often don't see all of the people who are kept out. And I think this is sort of another case where these eligibility requirements are leaving out a large number of trans women and also a lot of intersex and cis women with higher hormone levels, and we just don't even know it because it's this kind of invisible thing that is shaping who we get to see at the Olympics. And you know, unless an athlete comes forward and talks about not being eligible, like we won't even know who is impacted.
The book is The Other Olympians: Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sport. It's such an impressive corrective to what we think the history of the Olympics are. So thank you for the work, Michael Waters.
Thank you so much.
But I can't let you go without asking a question that I ask all writers, but particularly writers a little bit younger than myself, which is the question of music. Everybody I know who writes, music is a part of their process, either playing when they're writing, or maybe they're taking a break from writing and just escaping a little bit. What music was the soundtrack to the other Olympians?
Oh God. Well, I have to be honest that like the music that I listen to when I'm writing, I'm the kind of writer where I don't know, I'm not distracted by lyrics in like loud music. And so I would say it's not necessarily the most like thematically similar. I would say it has ranged from like while I was writing this, I think it ranged from, I mean, someone like Charlie XCX to like Stevie Wonder. Like I feel like I often am at this point in my listening to like Don't You Worry About a Thing and then doing the like Spotify radio and just letting it go. But you know, there's sometimes some really aggressive hyperpop that makes it in there as I'm writing about like 1930s. I don't know how that works thematically, but anything to sort of let me zone out and not be present in like the actual space, I think helps.
Absolutely, I hear that. I sometimes listen to songs that I've listened to death, so the lyrics don't interfere, but there's the familiar melody. Wait, but that's just me. Michael Waters, the other Olympians, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honor.
Oh, no, the honor's ours. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty, support The Nation magazine. We are out of here. Peace. I'm gonna hit stop recording.